It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The U.S. Supreme Court started a new session this month. Later in the hour, Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law will highlight some of the most significant cases currently being heard by the U.S. Supreme Court, including a case that brings up the question, how much religious freedom do you have in prison? Also, another case that deals with a husband threatening his wife via social media who claims he has a First Amendment right to do this. But before that, has the United States Supreme Court become just another partisan institution? Many Americans think so. Joining me for a few minutes to talk about politics and the perceptions of the High Court, Anthony Goggin is Associate Professor of Law at Drake University in Des Moines. Tony, welcome to our program.
Oh, thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here.
You wrote a recent piece in the Des Moines Register titled, Americans Must Not Lose Faith in the Supreme Court. First, before we talk about some of your defense for the Supreme Court, what is the current public opinion of it?
Well, Ben, there have been a number of polls recently that indicate the public is increasingly skeptical of the independence of the Supreme Court. There was a poll taken by the New York Times 2 years ago which found that 75% of Americans believe that the justices bring personal and ideological agendas to at least some of the cases that they hear. And then a poll earlier this year by the Gallup polling outfit concluded that over half of Americans disapprove of the Supreme Court's job performance. And that really is a strikingly high number.
Mm-hmm. I think that the Supreme Court, or the Gallup poll also sort of had this contradiction that there was a great deal of trust in the institution, but then this low approval. What does that mean?
That's right. I think that Americans still hold the institution of the Supreme Court in high regard, as well they should. But I think at the same time, we've seen in the last 5 years a number of very controversial Supreme Court decisions. And those decisions and the controversy that has surrounded them has undermined, to at least some extent, the public's confidence in the independence of the judiciary.
Mm-hmm. Talk about some of those cases. Which ones would you point to?
Well, certainly I'd say the most controversial case of the last 5 years was the Citizens United case from 2010. That was the case in which the Supreme Court essentially struck down the FEC's effort, I should say the Federal Election Commission's efforts to impose contribution limits on contributions to what are commonly called super PACs. These are independent expenditure groups that do not coordinate their activities with political parties or political candidates. And that ruling was 5-4, divided the court along conservative and liberal ideological lines. It was very harshly condemned by the President of the United States as well as by many, many commentators.
Mm-hmm. This was also figured into a State of the Union address, didn't it?
That's exactly right. Just a few weeks later, President Obama, after the decision was handed down, President Obama criticized the ruling, and there were at least four Supreme Court justices in the House chamber during the President's State of the Union. So it was a really interesting and unique example of a confrontation between, really a symbolic confrontation between two different branches of government.
Mm-hmm. Another case would the Hobby Lobby case, right?
Yes, absolutely. And that's a much more recent case. That was handed down just a few months ago. And in that case, once again, we had a 5-4 split in the court. And the conservative majority held that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is a 20-year-old act, provides for religious freedom rights for corporations as well as for individuals and other business entities as well. That was very controversial, like Citizens United.
Mm-hmm. How does the Supreme Court compare when we do this polling on the other branches of government, the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the legislative branch we know is at the bottom of the heap, right? All-time low approval ratings.
That's exactly right. The Supreme Court stands higher in public opinion than the executive and legislative branches. And so, relatively speaking, the Supreme Court is still doing well, but the trend lines clearly are concerning because the loss of public faith in, I shouldn't say complete loss of public faith, but the undermining of public faith in the White House and the Congress has been a process that has been underway really in some ways since the Vietnam War and the Watergate scandal in the 1970s. So the Supreme Court is really new to this process. of having its integrity and reliability challenged.
Mm-hmm. You pointed to the poll earlier in the conversation about many Americans believing that there are ideological agendas that the Supreme Court justices have. So why shouldn't we lose some faith in the Supreme Court if we believe that to be true? Is that not true?
Well, I think there are two points to make. The first is that the perception that the court divides 5-4 on a frequent basis is simply wrong. We know how the court breaks down in every case, and so we have years of records to look to. And the fact is, in the most recent Supreme Court term, the justices were unanimous in 2/3 of the cases that they heard. And in almost 80% of the cases, the justices agreed, or the majority had at least seven justices in agreement. So there's actually far more agreement mm-hmm. on the Supreme Court than is commonly understood. And even in the 5-4 cases, in this most recent term, the 2013-2014 term, only four cases came out 5-4 with the five Republican-appointed justices ruling in the majority and the four Democratic-appointed justices ruling in the minority. Now, of course, those were high-profile cases. One of them was Hobby Lobby, as you mentioned, Ben, and the second prominent case was the McCutcheon v. Federal Election Commission case, which was another campaign finance case. And I think what happened was those 5-4 splits are what dominated the public's attention. And all those cases where the court came out 9-0 or 8-1 or 7-2 were largely overlooked. And I think that's what results in this perception that the court's perpetually divided along ideological lines when, in reality, the justices agree more than they disagree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe what you're saying, but at the same time, from within the ranks of the Supreme Court justices, I was reading excerpts from an interview with the 81-year-old Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, seen as a member of the court's liberal wing. And I think the interviewer at this was Elle magazine asking her where she saw or how she saw the shift, the conservative shift in the court. And she pointed to Kennedy. That's the vote we always point to when we say that is the swing vote. Do you not see it that way?
Oh, well, I think she's certainly right when it comes to these major constitutional law cases in which you have a 4-4 split, conservative, liberal, and then Kennedy in the middle. That certainly was the case in Citizens United. That was the case in Hobby Lobby. But again, those cases are actually a very small percentage of the court's docket, mm-hmm. First and foremost. And secondly, it's noteworthy, you mentioned Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Antonin Scalia, who is arguably the most conservative member of the court, or perhaps Clarence Thomas, Antonin Scalia has said that his best friend on the Supreme Court is Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I think that's something that really speaks well of the court, that the justices have maintained a level of collegiality and respect and even affection, despite the fact that on some of these big cases, they do profoundly disagree in terms of what the statute or how a particular statute should be interpreted or how a constitutional provision should be interpreted. And I think that's something that, frankly, Congress could learn from. It's one thing to disagree. It's another thing to question your opponent's motives or intellectual integrity or honesty. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court has escaped that trap. But I think it's very important for the country to recognize that impugning the motives of the justices is in its own way just as damaging to our system as impugning the motives of any other public official.
Tony Goggin is my guest, associate professor of law at Drake University. So it seems to me you're leading, Tony, to the media being a culprit here, that the media may be taking – there may be some substance here, but then – exaggerating the differences in the court and the political agendas that the justices may have?
Well, I don't blame the media because I think in a lot of ways it's really actually partisans on both sides who do this. They're the ones – the media is reporting what's happened. And the phenomenon that I think's unfolded in the last couple of decades is not something that's been driven by the media. That what's driving this is political polarization in the country as a whole – and the fact that we increasingly view everything that happens in a, through a partisan lens. And so in that sense, I think the media is simply reflecting something that's going on in the country rather than actually driving it.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this court, Chief Justice Roberts. What sets this court apart? How is this court different when we look at other recent courts?
Well, certainly this court's more conservative than the court was 30 or 40 years ago. This court, here's a criticism of the court that is often made. One of the things that distinguishes this court is that there are no former politicians on the court. You know, Earl Warren was a famous Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in the 1950s and 60s. He was an attorney, but he was also a former politician. He'd been governor of California. So he brought a lot of real-world experience to the court. And a common criticism of the current court, and this is one that cuts across ideological lines, the criticism is that the current court is filled with former judges and that it doesn't have enough diversity in terms of the career paths of the people who sit in the court. Another criticism of the current court is the fact that all nine of the justices went to either Harvard, Yale, Stanford, or Columbia. And so there is an unusually strong influence exercised on the court by a relatively small number of law schools. But I would note, again, those are not criticisms that have an ideological or partisan angle to them. I think they're valid criticisms, but they're criticisms that apply regardless of how the justice votes in any given case.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the question of a polling, public perception, saying they have trust in the institution, but lower approval at this point in time than in more recent times in the Supreme Court. Why does the public's opinion matter in the courts? These are justices who are appointed for life, aren't they?
They are. The Constitution directs lifetime appointment. The words that the Constitution uses is for good behavior, but in Constitution speak, that means a lifetime appointment. And the justice's job is not to be responsive to public opinion. One reason we have a court system is to protect our rights irrespective of the will of the majority. The Constitution's designed to be a safeguard for all of us. And so I don't think public opinion matters in that sense. It's not the individual justices who I think need to be concerned with public criticism, but rather we as a society as a whole need to think about whether viewing every single public policy decision and every judicial ruling in partisan terms makes sense for our country in the long run. And I think the answer is it doesn't. I think we have to get to a point where we can recognize that reasonable minds can disagree. Reasonable minds can disagree regarding big campaign finance cases. Reasonable minds can disagree regarding First Amendment religious freedom cases. And the idea that we think that someone who disagrees with us is acting from some kind of malignant motive is not healthy for our system, because in a way it becomes mutual assured destruction. In the end, the system depends on everybody buying in to the idea that we have a marketplace of ideas and that good ideas will ultimately triumph, irrespective of who the author of that idea is.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that, but at the same time, we see so many debates about when the next retirement will be and who will fill that spot and who will be president when that retirement comes, who will get to appoint, and also what the makeup of the Senate will be to approve that next appointee. If our senators obviously believe there's a lot politically going on with the choosing of the next justices.
That's absolutely right, and that's always been the case. But it's designed that way for a reason. None of our branches of government is truly freestanding. They all are interdependent in their own way, and that's a good thing because checks and balances has been part of the secret of American success. But at the same time, we've established lifetime appointments for the Supreme Court justices. When I say we, I mean the framers of the Constitution, because once the justice is in place, we want them to have the freedom to interpret Supreme Court cases independently and not have to worry about what the political reception of it will be. So basically, we have a system in which the political role comes at the front end at the time of the appointment of the justice. But once the justice is in place, the political role is over.
Huge burning issue over the last 5 years and a huge swing in attitude surrounding same-sex marriage. Let me hear your opinion, because we'll certainly get that also from our next guest, Todd Pettis. Why did the High Court not take up any of the cases that could have settled the same-sex marriage question once and for all nationwide?
Well, I think it's an example of the court showing restraint. This is an issue that's playing out in public opinion. Clearly, we're beginning to see a consensus emerge in favor of same-sex marriage nationally, just among the public as a whole. The courts themselves are now, the lower federal courts are moving in that direction. The Iowa Supreme Court did 5 years ago. I think for all the talk of judicial activism, this issue is a good example of the Supreme Court realizing that it doesn't have to interject itself into every issue. It can wait and let events play out on their own. So I think that the court's recent decision was an act of wisdom on its part to stay out and let events continue to unfold.
Tony Goggin, Associate Professor of Law at Drake University, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. I'm joined now by Todd Pettis, Associate Dean for Faculty and the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Todd, welcome back to our studios.
Thanks for inviting me.
In just a moment, we want to have you take us through some of the most significant cases currently being heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. But let's talk about a couple of things, namely the same-sex marriage, the biggest news out of the Supreme Court as of late about the justices not taking any of the cases they might have. Now, you heard Tony Goggin's assessment there. Do you agree with that?
I do. I think he's probably right. There are a number of different theories. One theory is that the Supreme Court is most likely to get involved and should get involved when the lower courts are disagreeing. And we happen to be at a point in history right now where the lower federal appellate courts are all reaching a consensus, at least so far, and they across the country have been striking down bans on same-sex marriage. And if the lower federal appellate courts are speaking so far with one voice, there's less of an argument for the Supreme Court to get in. The Supreme Court is much more likely to get in if the federal courts that it supervises, the lower courts, are disagreeing on some important question. That's kind of a quintessential case when the justices would say, we've got a disagreement now, we have to settle it. If there's not disagreement among the lower federal courts, then there's not a strong argument for them to intervene. And that's one I think very likely explanation. If I had to put money on one, that's the one I'd put money on.
So what can you say about when the U.S. Supreme Court will eventually decide this? Because they will have to, won't they?
Well, it's not necessarily. I think it's likely that they will, but it's not guaranteed that they will. Right now, there's a case pending in front of, I think, the Sixth Circuit. And those who watch the oral arguments and so forth and have their eye on that case think that, you know, there's a possibility that the Sixth Circuit, which is the circuit covering part of the upper Midwest, a little bit east of us, there's a possibility that they will uphold a ban on same-sex marriage. And if they do, then we've got a disagreement among courts, and the odds of the Supreme Court taking on the issue, I think, go way up.
Okay. We'll have to stay tuned to that. Let's go back to the other issue, the main one. I was talking with Tony Goggin about these polls that show that many don't have faith in the U.S. Supreme Court, that or rather they see it as just another highly partisan institution. What about Tony's assessment there that we should have faith in the U.S. Supreme Court and not see every one of its acts through an ideological lens?
Well, I think he's right from several different angles. First of all, the statistics which he cited, it's very rare that we have 5-4 splits that divide along these kind of predictable ideological lines. Those tend to be very high-profile cases. They often are on very culturally significant issues, and so they get a lot of attention. But it's certainly not the norm. The overwhelming majority of cases that the judiciary as a whole and the Supreme Court in particular handle are handled in ways where you would not be able to perceive any kind of an ideological tilt in the votes. And he puts his finger on a very nice point. The friendship between Justice Ginsburg and Justice Scalia, which is a very deep, quite profound friendship. They're very important to one another. You'd have to be pretty cynical, I think, to say that these two justices kind of wink at each other and know, you know what, we're basically just ideological hacks doing what we – you know, acting out on our own preferences, and we each know that about the other, but we still really like each other. They have a lot of respect for each other, and they see each other working up close, and I think that tells us a lot about how they see the person who often comes down on the other side when we are going to have these 5-4 splits.
In the couple minutes before we go to break, another comment on some other news having to do with this U.S. Supreme Court. On Tuesday, the U.S. Supreme Court intervened in a lawsuit over a state law in Texas that would require clinics that provide abortion services to conform to standards for ambulatory surgery centers. In a couple minutes, can you tell us, put that in context, tell us what's going on there?
Yeah, Texas has enacted two quite significant changes in the way it regulates abortion. One is that they have required clinics that perform abortions to have someone, a physician on staff who has admitting privileges at a nearby hospital so that if something – the logic, I suppose, being that if something goes wrong at the clinic, we need to have a doctor on hand who can take that patient to a nearby hospital and begin to intervene in a more powerful way. The other requirement that Texas law imposes is that abortion clinics have much more advanced ambulatory surgical care facilities. And the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is one level down from the U.S. Supreme Court, and it covers that geographical region of the country, Texas plus a couple of other states. The Fifth Circuit has been working its way through these issues and had at least temporarily decided that these changes were fine and was going to allow both of these sets of laws to go into effect across the state. And the Supreme Court, and we don't know what the precise lineup of justices was, but at least five of them decided that that decision ought to be put on hold. They entered what we call a stay, which means that at least temporarily those two changes are not being put into effect statewide. It signals also that once the Fifth Circuit is done working its way through this case, the justices might well take an interest in it and then take a look.
So it could have implications for the nation as a whole.
It could. And, you know, it might be this term. The term will end in June. It might be next year. But, you know, whenever the Fifth Circuit rules on enters its final ruling and says, we've looked at everything, we're now done with this case, I think the odds are pretty good that the Supreme Court will, that there'll be at least four justices. And that's what it takes. It takes four justices to decide to take a case to agree to hear it. And I think the odds are pretty good that four justices are going to want to take a second look at that issue.
Okay. Glad to have you with us. Todd Pettis, Associate Dean for Faculty in H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Please stay with us, Todd Pettis, as we then dive into some of the most important, most significant cases currently before the Supreme Court. A few of them have been heard or will be heard in the coming weeks. And Todd will give us his read on these, what it means for each of us when we come back, including a case that brings up the question, how much religious freedom do you have in prison? Another case that deals with a husband who threatened his wife via social media but claims he has a First Amendment right to do so. We'll come back with plenty more cases. I'm Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Our eyes are on the Supreme Court this hour. My guest, Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law, where he is Associate Dean for Faculty, also the Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. And this half hour, we want to highlight some of the most significant cases currently before the U.S. Supreme Court. The latest term started this month. So let's go through some of these, get a sense of the questions before the case, before the court, and some of the stories behind them. Todd Pettis, let's start with a case that has a story in the case of a driver for a UPS truck. What happened?
Yes, the employee's name is Peggy Young. So the case is called Young versus UPS. If people want to look it up and follow it, and it has to do with what your rights are in the workplace when you are pregnant. And in particular, there's a statute that Congress passed some years ago called the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. And the battle in this case is about exactly what that act demands. The story, very briefly, is that during Peggy Young's pregnancy, she was advised by her doctor that she should not lift more than 20 pounds. She was a driver for UPS, and part of the job description for a UPS driver is that you'd be able to lift, I think it's 70 pounds, among other things. And so she said, you know, there's going to be a period of time here where I can't do that. Can you put me somewhere else in the company?
And she brought a note from her doctor.
She did, yeah. And there's no debate at all in the case about whether this was a valid piece of advice from her doctor. Everyone accepts that this was indeed a medical requirement. She wanted to continue to work during much of her pregnancy, but she couldn't do that same job. So she asked for a brief reassignment, and UPS declined to do that. UPS does temporarily accommodate two or three other categories of kind of temporary incapacities. For example, if you suffer an on-the-job injury and the on-the-job injury keeps you from doing your ordinary job, you know, they'll move you to a telephone bank or something else and have you work there until you're able to come back. And so the battle here is about what this Pregnancy Discrimination Act requires, and it requires either of two things. UPS says all that the Pregnancy Discrimination Act requires of us is that when we're coming up with our policy about who gets leave, who gets a temporary reassignment and so forth, we have to be pregnancy neutral. In other words, we can't say we're going to zero in on pregnant women and enact a policy that somehow targets them for unfavorable treatment. But as long as we're writing a policy that's it's not hostile to pregnancy. There are a lot of other kinds of injuries, for example, off-the-job injuries. There's a lot of different kinds of, you know, you hurt your back, for example, while mowing the lawn or something. UPS won't accommodate that. So they say we're being neutral with respect to pregnancy. Mm-hmm. Peggy Young is arguing that the statute demands more than that. And what and there's language in the statute that gives her a foothold for this argument. And what she's saying is that if the incapacity that I have, the inability to work that I have, is similar to the inability that other employees have that you are accommodating, then you have to accommodate me too, okay? And so if the person who suffered an on-the-job injury and they can't lift more than 20 pounds and you found a job for them, she says the Pregnancy Discrimination Act requires that you give me a reassignment too instead of just telling me to go home until it's over.
This is a case to be heard, I understand, not until December, so we'll wait to see there and to also pick apart implications on a later date here. Let's go to another case that's to be heard in December. This is the one where a husband threatened his wife via social media, but cites the First Amendment and says, I'm doing this as freedom of expression.
Yes, that's right. And this case is called Elonis. It's Elonis versus United States. And in this gentleman, he was in his mid-20s. His wife of several years leaves him, takes the kids with her. He, to put it mildly, he does not take it well. And among other things, he puts up several posts on Facebook. And I'll just to give you a quick flavor, I'm just going to read you a couple of them. And he's ultimately prosecuted for the posts I'm about to read, and he's now doing prison time, though challenging the legality of that. But one of his posts, for example, says, what's interesting is that it's very illegal to say that I really, really think someone out there should kill my wife. I've also found out that it's incredibly illegal, extremely illegal, to go on Facebook and say something like the best place to fire a mortar launcher at her house would be from the cornfield behind it because of easy access to a getaway road and you'd have a clear line of sight through the sunroom. There's another one where he says, fold up your protection from abuse order and put it in your pocket. Do you think it's thick enough to stop a bullet? One more, I'll just paraphrase. He says, you know, I'm going to go look for an elementary school in the area and make a name for myself because there's no fury like a crazy man. Well, federal officials descend on him and they prosecute him under a federal statute that makes it a crime to, in the language of the statute, transmit a communication, and a Facebook post would count, that can constitute a threat to harm someone else. And there's two questions here. They're very related. The first is, now, are you guilty under this statute only if you intend to make a threat or if just someone could reasonably perceive it as a threat? His defense is, I didn't intend these as actual threats. I was venting. In some cases, I was kind of mimicking in some ways some rap lyrics or a comedy troupe's performance.
I have another one of those quotes. Based on what you said, it's hard to believe when he has a quote like, I'm not going to rest until your body is a mess soaked in blood, dying from all the little cuts.
Yeah. Well, he says he's an aspiring rapper. He says this is therapeutic for him to vent in this way, and I didn't ever actually mean to do it. The government didn't buy it. The lower courts didn't buy it. As I say, they convicted and sentenced him. He says the statute doesn't reach me unless I actually intended to do it. And if the statute does reach me in the absence of intent actually to harm, then that violates my First Amendment rights.
Mm-hmm. Any guesses on how this will come out here? I mean, people listening, and you and I have probably formed opinions, but do you have a guess as the high court will say?
You know, it might – I don't know. Maybe it'll surprise you to hear me say it, but I don't think this is going to be a 9-0 vote. There's lots of cases involving very ugly speech. I'll mention the Westboro Baptist case just as an example, where people go to a military funeral and hold up very offensive signs celebrating 9/11, celebrating the deaths of American soldiers, and they go to a funeral of a fallen Marine and they picket there. And the court, by a strong majority, held that they had a free speech right to do that. So it's tough to predict.
Also,
this case.
Also, we've talked about on this program the so-called Gamergate, where we have, especially in the area of online gaming, video gaming, some words being exchanged there, very violent things being said. So implications very wide in this case.
Yes, and social media adds an element to it, because we all know just if you're – it's easy to be misunderstood when you send an email because you lack tone, you lack inflection and so forth. And so what the balance the court's going to have to strike here is – you know, we want to protect people from being put in fear of harm. On the other hand, we don't want to chill speech and put such a disincentive that people have valuable things to say but are afraid to say them because someone out there might take it as a threat.
Todd Pettis is with us. He's Associate Dean for Faculty and also the Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. We're buzzing through some court cases, high-profile cases before the Supreme Court right now. Another case that was actually, I believe, already heard, Holt v. Hobbs, a case that brings up the question, how much religious freedom does a person have behind bars?
Yes, this is one of the first cases that was argued this term, the what we call a term. It always begins on the first Monday of October, and that's when the court kicks off its new season. This case has to do with one of a pair of statutes that Congress enacted in response to an earlier Supreme Court ruling. There was a decision called Employment Division versus Smith that came down in 1990 that read the free exercise of religion clause of the Constitution pretty narrowly. And there were many in Congress who thought that Americans ought to have more religious freedom than the court had said they had under the Constitution. And so Congress's solution to that problem was to pass a couple of different statutes saying that when the government does – and then they spelled out different circumstances – but when the government does something that really inhibits your ability to practice your religion, they have to have a very powerful justification. And one of those statutes involves institutionalized persons. The name of the statute is the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. We pronounce it by its acronym, which is RLUIPA. And RLUIPA says that if a state or federal prison has enacted a policy or is doing something that's infringing on a prisoner's ability to exercise his or her religion, the government has to have a very compelling justification for it. And in this case, we have a Muslim prisoner who wants to grow a beard because he says it's one of the dictates of his faith. He says, I'm willing to keep it trimmed. I want it at 1/2 inch. So he wants a half-inch beard. The Arkansas prison where he's being held, unlike most other prisons in the country, has said we're not going to let you do it. If there's a medical reason why you need to grow a short beard, we would allow it, but we're not going to accommodate this. And we're not going to allow it because we worry about prison security. This case, if you were to judge by the tone of the oral argument, is almost definitely going to come down on the side of the prisoner because the justices were really struggling, it seemed, from their questions to try to understand now what's the security threat exactly from having a half-inch beard. You can't hide a weapon in it. The attorney who was arguing the case for the state said, well, you know, he could go out into the workyard, shave and thereby change his appearance and thereby somehow be able to do certain thing or move around in the prison in a way kind of under a false identity while the prison guards are temporarily not recognizing him. The justices did not seem persuaded by that argument. And so I think a lot of folks are predicting a 9-0 ruling here.
Sometimes isn't it not true that by listening to the arguments, you can be thrown off as far as a decision. But in this case, you think you're on fairly firm ground.
That's true.
The justices are thinking.
People in my profession would say I'm foolish to make predictions based on oral argument. They're probably right because it is often difficult to tell. But when you add up the total number of questions asked and look at the content of those questions, there was a lot of skepticism on the court. And looking at the way that the Arkansas attorney responded to those, it's tough to find 5 votes saying that the prison is going to be able to do what it's doing.
Another case that the Supreme Court has taken up I don't know if the I don't think it's been heard. A date not set when it will be taken up. But it also has to do with religious liberty. This is the EEOC v. Abercrombie. This is Abercrombie and Fitch, the store, as we know.
Yes. A young woman, she was then 17 years old, named Samantha Eloff, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, goes to the local shopping mall and applies for a job at an Abercrombie kids store. She is Muslim, and when she appears for her job interview, she's wearing a black headscarf, which is what she understands her religion to require of her. And Abercrombie has what's called a look policy. They call the people who are on their sales floor models. It's very important to the Abercrombie company that people who work for them dress in a particular way and act in a particular way. They see that as an important part of their advertising and their protection of their brand. And the assistant manager who interviewed Ms. Eloff didn't ask about why Samantha was wearing the headscarf, but she did take note of it. She called a supervisor on the phone and said, I've got this job applicant wearing the headscarf. I think it's because she's Muslim. And
But there was no discussion about it in the interview, evidently.
No, and that goes ultimately to the heart of the legal case. There was no discussion of it in the interview. And the supervising manager said, well, give her a low rating on appearance. We're not going to hire her. She then sued, saying that this violates her rights under the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which, among many other things, bars employers from discriminating against people based on their religion. And that same statute also says that employers have to reasonably accommodate people's religious practice when it wouldn't put some kind of undue hardship on the company. And the legal issue in this case is, what is it that triggers the employer's duty to accommodate? What Abercrombie is saying is that we don't have a duty to accommodate religion in this case unless the applicant expressly tells us and raises the question, says, I'm wearing a headscarf, I'm wearing it for religious reasons, is that going to be a problem? Abercrombie says, if that happens, then we have a duty to accommodate. But if the applicant says nothing about it, then we don't have a duty. Mm. The EEOC, which is handling the case on behalf of Ms. Eloff, the EEOC says, we shouldn't put the burden on the job applicant to raise the question. The employer is more likely to know of any possible conflicts. They note the headscarf. They know what their look policy is, and they should be the ones to raise it. And here they had reason to think that this was for religious reasons. And indeed, the woman who did the first interview suspected as much. And so then the EEOC's judgment that imposed on Abercrombie a duty to accommodate. And instead of accommodating, Abercrombie elected not to hire her.
So a case where also employers will be wanting to see how the high court rules. Todd Pettis with us of the University of Iowa College of Law, going through some of the cases currently before the Supreme Court in this session, some having been heard, some will be heard in the coming weeks. A couple more to accommodate on our docket for this half hour, Todd Pettis. Is it Hyen v. Carolina, something to do with a police officer actually making a mistake and it leading to other consequences? What happened here?
Yeah, well, there's multiple mistakes made, but the officer made one of them. Briefly, the story is a couple guys are driving down the road. Sheriff is watching traffic pass, and he noticed, and here's, a little tip for how to avoid being pulled over. The sheriff says, the driver looked nervous to me. And why did he look nervous? He was holding his hands at the 10 and 2 position on the wheel and looking straight ahead. So he just looked a little nervous. So I started to follow
that's
him.
That's what I was taught in driver's ed.
That's what we're all taught to do. But apparently that makes us look a little uptight and makes us look suspicious, at least for this, when you're driving down this stretch of North Carolina highway. So the officer follows him and then finds out during the course of following him that one of the taillights isn't functioning. So he pulls the guy over, cites him for the taillight functioning. They complete that little transaction. Then the officer says, while we're here, how about I search your car? Now, it turns out there's cocaine in the car. And why someone in those circumstances would say, sure, search my car, that's a mistake. But it's a mistake that was made. And they search the car. And it takes them about 40 minutes, 40 minutes. So after 40 minutes of this search, for which there wasn't a warrant, but there was consent, the guy said, sure, search the car. They uncovered the cocaine. And then they're prosecuted for the drug crime. The issue here is, this whole thing was set in motion when the officer pulled the guys over for having a burned out tail light. And it turns out that under North Carolina law, you are required to have, quote, a stop lamp in the singular on your car. And so the officer, the North Carolina lower – the North Carolina court said the officer was wrong in thinking that it's a crime.
If one of the taillights is working, that's good
enough.
You
just need one functioning taillight under North Carolina law. And so the guys who had the drugs are saying that this whole sequence of events that led to the discovery of the drugs – all started when the officer made a mistake about the law. And so the question is, does that make the search unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment? The Fourth Amendment protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures. Is it unreasonable for the police to stop you based on a mistaken understanding of the law?
Mm-hmm. So it seems here when we spin this out, if the court would decide one way that officers can make mistakes and it can lead to these unintended consequences, that officers might be led to make more mistakes intentionally.
Well, if that were to happen, there would and we knew it was intentionally, and that does open up a bit of can of worms whenever you try to figure out is someone acting intentionally or not.
Yeah.
But if that were to happen, it would be a violation of the Fourth Amendment almost undoubtedly. But when you look at the language of the Fourth Amendment, it protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures. And this case has already been in front of the court. In fact, it was the first one they heard on that first Monday of October. The justices seemed to be leaning in favor of the officer.
In favor of the officer, that yeah, the officer can make a small mistake like this, and we the evidence of
that was the mood in the room on that day. We'll see what the opinion says when it comes down.
Okay. The final case that we wanted to have you talk about, Todd, is Ohio v. Clark. Now, this has to do with a statement made by a three-year-old in his preschool to his preschool teachers about what a bruise on his face.
Yeah. Little boy, as you say, 3 years old. He's dropped off at daycare. The teachers notice some marks on his face, kind of a bloodshot eye. They ask him to lift up his shirt, and on his torso there's red marks. It looks like he's been beaten. And so they ask him who did this, and they have to ask him a few times. But he ultimately says, D. D did it. And it turns out D is the nickname for his mother's boyfriend who had dropped him off that morning. And this happened in Ohio. Ohio, like I think every state in the country, has a mandatory reporting obligation that puts the duty on teachers and others that if they see evidence of abuse, they need to report it to social services or somebody. And so the teachers did what they were obligated to do. They reported it to social services. And ultimately, this little boy and his sister were found in pretty rough condition. The mother, who was out of town that day, ultimately pled guilty and is doing 8 years for facilitating. She pled to child endangerment and I think facilitating child abuse, maybe some other things too. The boyfriend was prosecuted for the beatings. The main evidence against him was what this boy had said to other people. Okay, you have got a Sixth Amendment right under the Constitution to confront your witnesses.
Even if it's a three-year-old.
Even if it's a three-year-old. And the three-year-old never testified. And so this defendant never had a chance to cross-examine the little boy and say, why did you say D? And so he's saying that his conviction is a violation of his Confrontation Clause rights. And the Ohio Supreme Court agreed with him.
Anyone who's ever been around a three-year-old, and we were all three-year-olds at one point, knows that on one hand, you know, three-year-olds can say a lot of things.
Yes. Well, in this case, the little boy, when the time for trial came, the prosecution would have liked him to testify, but the judge ruled that he wasn't competent to testify because when he was asked questions about what his birthday was, how old his sister was, who lives in the house with you, he gave inconsistent answers. And so the judge made a decision that the little boy wasn't a trustworthy enough witness to have him testify live at the trial. And so the defendant's saying that that's exactly my point.
Ohio v. Clark, the last of our half dozen cases that you've walked us through. Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law, thank you for being with us. Tell us what happens now. Remind us. So the court is in this phase of hearing oral arguments week after week. What comes next and when will we know more about these particular cases?
Well, they publish their calendar online. If you have an interest in these cases or any others, you can either go to the Supreme Court's official website or you can go to SCOTUS blog, which is Supreme Court of the United States, the acronym SCOTUS blog. It's a fantastic blogging service run by some attorneys in Washington, D.C. that lay out the calendar. They report on cases as they're argued. They have someone in the courtroom who will tell you about how the arguments went. They'll tell you what's coming up. It's a great way to follow the court.
Todd Pettis, Associate Dean for Faculty and the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Always fascinating cases. You have an interesting line of work. More than interesting, fascinating, Todd.
I do. I'm lucky.
we'll talk to you again soon as more developments in these cases and others come to the surface. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. We had help from John Pemble in Des Moines for this program. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Oh, it's a news buzz tomorrow on Friday. You'll want to stay tuned for that tomorrow at this time. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.